This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily via the internet address www.parstoday.com/en. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Intelsat 902, and Eutelsat satellite, as well as via internet. You can also listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for more details.
And now we enlighten you with Ayah 260 to 263 of Surah Baqarah, recited by Shahriyar Parhizgar.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. وَإِذْ قَالَ إِبْرَاهِيمُ رَبِّ أَرِنِي كَيْفَ تُحْيِي الْمَوْتَى قَالَ أَوَلَمْ تُؤْمِنْ قَالَ بَلَى وَلَكِنْ لِيَطْمَئِنَّ قَلْبِي قال فخذ أربعة من الطير فصرهن إليك ثم اجعل على كل جبل منهن جزءا ثم ادعهن يأتينك سعيا واعلم أن الله عزيز حكيم مثل الذين ينفقون أموالهم في سبيل الله كمثل حبة أنبتت سبع سنابل في كل سنبلة 100 حبة والله يضاعف لمن يشاء والله واسع عليم الذين ينفقون أموالهم في سبيل الله ثم لا يتبعون ما أنفقوا منا ولا أذى لهم أجرهم عند ربهم ولا خوف عليهم ولا هم يحزنون قول معروف ومغفرة خير من صدقة يتبعها أذى والله غني حليم.
In the name of Allah, and when Abraham said, My Lord, show me how you revive the dead. He said, Do you not believe? He said, Yes, indeed, but in order that my heart may be at rest. He said, Take 4 of the birds, then cut them into pieces, and place a part of them on every mountain. Then call them, they will come to you, hastening, and know that Allah is Almighty and All-Wise. Those who spend their wealth in the way of Allah and then do not follow what they have spent with reproaches and affronts, they shall have their reward near their Lord, and they will have no fear, nor will they grieve. An honorable word with pardon is better than a charity followed by affront, and Allah is all-sufficient, most forbearing.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily for listeners across the globe. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard via the internet, FM, and satellites. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on IranSat or BAT 5. And Intelsat 39 and via the internet. Our internet address is iranradio.ir. And now you can listen to Arabi English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program, PO Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about our audio quality and other means. Thank you.
Doing a sound from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
And welcome to Spotlight. I'm Marzia Hashimi. Thanks so much for being with us. Well, one of the main goals of the U.S. sanctions was to isolate Iran from the rest of the world and to devastate its economy. Well, neither isolation nor devastation has been the result of the illegal sanctions, although pressure has been put on the people and on Iran's economy. Though media campaigns may have made some think that Iran's economy has been destroyed, the reality is that the Islamic Republic, despite all the sanctions and restrictions, has the 22nd strongest economy in the world, according to Purchasing Power Parity, PPP. On this spotlight, we will take a look at how Iran has not only stayed afloat, but has grown economically, and the reason the economic future seems bright for Tehran. I'd like to welcome my guests to the program. Yusomisha Ahmadi, right here in Tehran. And Matthew Eretz, Senior Fellow, American University in Moscow, out of Montreal.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Let me start this off with Matthew in Montreal. Now, Iran was the most sanctioned country in history until sanctions were put on Russia due to the Ukraine situation. I'd like to hear your assessment of Iran's economic growth and technological advancements, I mean, despite all these restrictions.
Yeah, what we found is that the alliance, the survivors alliance, especially between Iran, China, Russia, has increased dramatically with an emphasis upon creating autonomous supply lines, supply chains, as well as new ports, mega infrastructure projects, and even space development and nuclear, the pioneering frontier technologies of the 21st century. We know that Russia and Iran have an important deal in the Chabahar port to build a spaceport. That is an important aspect of cutting-edge science that filters down to every other aspect of the economy. The GDP and other metrics pertaining to Iran's physical economic health have been generally improving in ways that all of the Western think tanks have said would be impossible. And I think that this is a very lawful thing.
All right. Well, thanks, Matthew. Gisu, let's look at the overall situation. Now, Iran has reached out to countries throughout the world to expand its economic potential. Let's look at this. And it has been said by some that Iran is isolated. But would you say that the reality is something else?
Well, definitely, as something else, Marzia. Mm. Today, Tehran International Fairgrounds was bustling with activities. There are delegations from more than 100 countries, business delegations, taking part in this year's expo, which is dubbed Expo 2025. There are more than 2,000 different businesses that are being represented there. Immense opportunities, particularly since you mentioned Iran being isolated. I would have to note that there are over 70 delegations from the African continent only, and those are high-ranking delegations. Some of them are even represented by their Minister of Commerce, and of course heads of the Chambers of Commerce are all present seeking to expand their businesses with Iran.
Okay, I'm going to get back to some of those points that you just made, but let me cross back over to Matthew right now. Now, Matthew, let's look at some of the organizations that Iran has become part of, for example, like BRICS and the Shanghai Cooperation Organization. Do you see this creating increased economic opportunity for Iran in the future?
Well, certainly, yeah. I mean, the BRICS is growing in a robust way. There's now 9 full members, many more associate members of this, and Iran plays a very key role, both as I believe an important point of conjunction of East and West through the Belt and Road Initiative. There's several different points of contact there, as well as the North-South International Transportation Corridor that was begun in, formally speaking, over 20 years ago, but has really begun to take on a very, very powerful life in synergy with the Belt and Road Initiative that passes through the Arctic in Russia's far north, all the way down through the Caspian region with multitudes of branch-off points and industrial development corridors down into the southern ports of Chabahar, Bandar Abbas from the Iranian south. And that would then connect into and does connect into India, a very important trade partner as well, with a huge growth potential into the future. So Iran's relationship in the BRICS, which is potentially going to be, this has been postponed, sabotaged more than it should have been, but I believe that the BRICS is providing a foundation for a viable economic and security architecture outside of the control of the SWIFT and the one-world hegemonists of the Anglo-American Zionist axis that are otherwise wishing to have some form of unilateral command over all of the nations of the world. So I think, yeah, Iran's involvement in all of these multipolar institutions are of great importance.
Right, indeed. Well, Gisu, let me pick up on you mentioned first Expo 2025, and also you mentioned there's another conference that's going on right now, the Third Iran-Africa Economic Cooperation Conference. I want to look at that because one of the most treasured markets in the world, of course, is the whole African continent, and it contains some of the fastest growing economies and markets, along with a young workforce, growing infrastructure needs, and massive wealth potential due to its natural resources. Now, Iran wants to create its presence and its cooperation with various African countries. Let's look at this with this, for example, conference going on right now, the potential there, the possibilities.
Well, the possibilities are immense, and not just today in the opening ceremony of Expo 2025, but also yesterday in the opening ceremony of the third Iran-Africa Economic Cooperation Conference. Also, the president did underscore Iran's open-door policy when it comes to expanding its business relations with other countries, and particularly this third African conference that you just mentioned, which is currently underway in Iran, has offered immense opportunities to African countries. Over 70 delegations, all of them are high-ranking delegations, by the way, Marzia. Mm-hmm. Like I said, most of them are represented by the Minister of Commerce or, in some cases, the Minister of Foreign Affairs. They are not only going to familiarize themselves with opportunities that exist in Tehran, but they will also be traveling all the way to Isfahan, another major business hub of Iran, and they will be able to visit the different industrial sectors of Isfahan and familiarize themselves with the business opportunities that exist there.
Okay, well, Matthew, let's look at it, because in my intro, I talked about basically the demonization that has taken place of Iran. And actually, many do not know the strength of the Iranian economy. As I mentioned, it's the 22nd strongest economy in the world, according to PPP. Tell me about what needs to be done because of this long process of demonization to actually, in your perspective, show the potential that Iran holds for not only itself, but for the world. As Iran has said, it is opening up, it's open to business for the majority of countries in the world.
I mean, Iran has acted so consistently in good faith, despite the provocative maneuvers that have been put in threats against her very survival over decades. And it's astounding to see the consistency of the message and willingness to cooperate with everyone. I mean, I think that spirit of openness is playing the long game. There's been a lot of efforts to try to provoke Iran to go into a Hobbesian eye for an eye sort of emotional foreign policy, which never works and always is a great recipe towards self-destruction. Looking throughout all of recorded history, that's how we've seen empires manage their victims and their targets, is to push them into a corner in order to get them to react out of emotion and create things that will ultimately undo their own existence. So Iran has played the high ground, has suffered many provocations. We don't need to list that here. But that being said, I think that the very success, that just being successful and demonstrating that there is that the image that we're being told in the Western media is a complete lie when you look at the fact that Iran not only has never been caught by any court in the world as being behind terrorism, although Westerners are being lied to profusely, being told that Iran is this demonic force behind international terrorism. It's actually the CIA. It's the Zionists that are going to get us closer to that. Iran's very ability to create peace. I mean, we know that Iran has done a great job helping to put out fires on the diplomatic front between India and Pakistan in early 2000s, and the current government there has shown a very open desire, and I think it should be taken up, this offer to be the mediator between current tensions that are being inflamed by external forces trying to get conflict between Pakistan and India once again. So I think just having a historic role as a peacemaker as well, to put out fires where the West is starting fires, is very important. And then also just demonstrating that despite the suffocating sanctions, success and cooperation has been able to win the day. And we're seeing a lot of positivity towards industrial as well as cooperative indexes on, as the other guest was pointing out, on the Africa front, a great openness to helping to work with partners in Africa on advanced science and basic needs. Latin America is another hub for cooperation. Obviously, the U.S. is seeing that as their backyard to be consolidated right now. And so there's a big fight over what Latin America's future is going to be. But that being said, there's a lot of potential there as well. There's so many points creative. But again, the Russia-China collaboration with Iran is, I think, the most important formula to make all of this work.
Okay. Well, Gisu, you were at the Expo 2025. I want to get back to that when you talked about the number of countries that were participating. Because as I was telling Matthew, in looking at the way the mainstream media has demonized Iran and the perspective that many have. But I want to talk about what you saw on the ground there, the various delegations from various countries. And obviously, they see potential. Otherwise, they wouldn't be here.
Clearly, 100 nations being represented now in the Iran Expo 2025 in and of itself speaks very loudly about how Iran is being perceived, particularly by countries who want to do business with Iran. It's interesting that you should point that, because I talked to a number of Bahraini businessmen who were here seeking to expand their business operations with the help of Iranian investors, and that is exactly what they said. They had mentioned that they had the experience of doing business with Iran on for a couple of years, and now they've reached a point where they are seeking to expand those relations and make investments in different sectors related to their own businesses. They said that Iranians are very good business people, and the quality of work that they deliver and the quality of products that they deliver is also very impressive, and that was the reason why they were here. On the other side, like I said, there were lots of African delegations that were present, the Russians, the Chinese. Well, they're traditional Iranian business partners, so you would expect to see many of those being represented here. But seeing that people from the African continent are so keen to attract business investments in their own representative countries and asking Iranians to come and do business with them in their countries was quite impressive, Marzi.
Okay. All right. Well, Matthew, let's look at it because we know with the U.S., with the illegal sanctions that they've implemented against Iran, it's one thing if the U.S. was just sanctioning Iran. One of the main problems, of course, is that they would sanction other countries doing business with Iran or put pressure on other countries doing business with Iran. I want to talk about that aspect now. Are we seeing a transition? Because as we see this transition, this economic and political transition from the West to the East, do you think that opens up the potential for other countries to get around those type of sanctions because either from the monetary perspective, they're not going to be that reliant on the dollar as they have been, and increasing these alliances with each other? How do you see that playing in all of this?
Yes, I do. And I think that even saner or at least rational heads in Washington even see where the wind is blowing and that the idea of the U.S. dollar as the global reserve currency, which has been the case since Bretton Woods in 1944, those days are quickly coming to an end as a new economic architecture is certainly being brought online. And I think there's a fight over what the characteristic of that economic architecture is going to be. And I think that we have, on the one hand, an effort to try to create sort of a set of spheres of influences of regional empires, which certain think tanks, the Brookings, the CFR and Rand Corps groupings are pushing on. I think that that involves some idealized sense of breaking up the Russia-China alliance. And obviously, I think that behind the scenes, there's probably a lot of threats and pressure being put on Iran to try to weaken its bond, especially with China, but also with Russia, but especially with China, from the forces representing the U.S. side of the diplomatic talks around the new nuclear deal. The wild card of Israel, I think, is also a factor. We know that Brookings put forth in 2009 a proposal, which I think became national policy, based upon the idea of having a good cop, bad cop relationship with Iran, with Bibi Netanyahu, even then being suggested to be the catalyzer, the bad cop, threatening Iran in order to subdue and completely accept all of the conditions being put onto Iran from Washington itself, while Washington might say, oh, we don't really want to go to war with you, but, you know, we can't necessarily stop Israel. So, you know, you have very, I think, dishonest agencies currently at play, trying very hard to get Iran to say, you know, okay, well, let's sign a deal, and we don't want to be necessarily the part of World War III. But I think that there are more subtle negotiations and agreements being made. We know that the Russians, the Chinese, and the Iranians have all been meeting, including with members of the IAEA, just this week before the third meeting of U.S.-Iranian officials had met up to discuss how to navigate this storm. The best-case scenario would be if Iran could both get the benefits of getting some sanctions removed, which is some of the promises that Trump has been making, while at the same time being able to really get control and maintain sovereignty over her nuclear energy sector, with the help of Russia and China ensuring that this would not be taken advantage of by certain forces that would like to still get a strike, an invasion of Iran. That has never disappeared. So I think it's very important that people keep that in mind. But, you know, I just keep going back to the fact that Iran, just like to be a truly sovereign country in the 21st century, requires nuclear power. They are committed to developing civilian nuclear power. There is a fatwa against the development of weapons, of nuclear weaponry. And so, you know, Iran has just signed every nuclear agreement internationally and has cooperated like a first-class nation on every point. And it's really been the U.S. Neocons that have been obstructing and trying to provoke a war for many, many decades now. So I think people need to really just wake up and realize that Iran is being the honest, consistent actor, that they need nuclear power just like everybody does. We need to have new relationships because the current U.S. dollar is sitting on a time bomb, a speculative derivatives time bomb that is going to explode and unleash a lot of chaos. And I think you've got certain people inside the United States that are trying to manage that chaos in order to bring about some form of new centralized digital currency that's, you know, a little bit more controlled top down and will remove a lot of the freedoms that people have taken for granted, at least in the Western nations of the transatlantic. As part of this transition, their idea would be, though, to do everything possible to destroy China, especially, which is recognized by Pete Hegseth and many officials around Trump, as well as Democrats. I would say it's not a Republican issue, as being the only peer competitor that would be capable of really resisting on an economic and cultural level the aspirations to one world hegemony of those in Washington and the city of London currently. So that's something in my mind.
Okay. Well, Gisa, you heard Matthew talk about basically this chaos that has been created and U.S. basically sitting on a time bomb. I want your perspective about the role of all of this. I mean, has Trump, and not only Trump, but Washington in general, basically shot themselves in the foot with trying to put crippling sanctions on Iran? They have not been able to paralyze Iran. And on the other hand, they see the numerous opportunities that actually they see the Chinese, they see the Russian, they see other countries that are getting closer to Iran. Do you think any of that plays into, because we're in the middle of these talks and direct talks between the U.S. and Iran, do you see it playing a role in any of that?
Exactly, definitely. That is also one of the options that we do know are on the table as far as the U.S. is concerned. The immense opportunities that exist in Iran, definitely the U.S. feels left out at this point in time, considering the business partners that Iran has. Clearly, the sanctions, as you mentioned yourself, the U.S. has shot itself in the foot because those sanctions have become completely useless, not just because Iran has been able to expand its business relations beyond just a few European or Western countries and the U.S. To, like I said, lots of countries around the world, including the African continent, Latin America. These are important business partners, let alone Russia and China, that have always been present whenever Iran has needed any kind of help. So the fact that these sanctions have eventually isolated the United States itself rather than isolating Iran, the U.S. does feel left out. We do know that this is one of the options that the negotiating team is presenting to the United States. We have heard the Iranian president also mention that a few times, and we're going to have to wait and see as far as the negotiations are concerned how much of a role that is going to play. But what really is important to note at this point in time is that Iran, with nearly 19 million people, is a great market. There's a lot of opportunities. And, of course, anyone at this point in time would want to do business in Iran.
Right. And Matthew, final question. We have like 1 minute. Your perspective, the future, the economic future in the Islamic Republic of Iran, how do you assess it?
I think it's the beachhead of a completely new multipolar renaissance for humanity as a whole. I think the salvation of literally the human species is contingent upon the civilizational power of Iran, of Persia, what it represents in human civilization's experience, and its harmonization as part of the revival of the New Silk Road with Confucian Buddhist cultures, Hindu cultures, Russian, you know, representing the Christian world in a very powerful manner that I think could be potentially the best of what humanity has ever offered. Inversely, I think there are certain Dark Age factions that are willing to light all of that on fire and bring in some form of techno-feudalism, even if it means unleashing hell on Earth, which is a scary thing that is in play right now. But I think that Iran is very smart. They've got centuries, millennia of experience dealing with crusader types. And I have faith that they can get through this.
And on that note, I thank both of you for being with me. Matthew Arad, a senior fellow at American University of Moscow. Out of Montreal, Gisu, Misha Ahmadi, right here in the studio with me, out of Tehran. And thank you for being with us on another Spotlight. I'm Marzia Hashemi. Goodbye.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
Why there is a need for a government which will be established by the Wali of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala.
In one of the letters that he writes to Sheikh Mufid, he tells us one of the ways that we can end the ghiba.
Let us see how one can prepare for the advent of the zuhur of Imam Mahdi, Sahib al-Zaman.
This is Dialogue, an introduction to the most important dialogues and conversations of Imam al-Mahdi, alayhi salam.
Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. The program is Dialogue, and I'm your host, Mahdi. Today we want to talk about one of the great personalities in the history of Islam, Imam al-Mahdi, ajalallahu ta'ala farajahu sharif. Please stay tuned. The 12th divinely appointed Imam, Imam al-Mahdi, may Allah hasten his reappearance, is the one who brings hope to all of humanity. As the world is being grinded between the oppressors and tyrants of the age, we look towards the heavens so that the advent of the 12th divinely appointed Imam comes sooner. We raise our hands in prayers, and we raise our hands in supplications, so that the awaited Savior of humanity comes and brings the final hope and salvation that humanity is so yearning for and desiring. The sights and the eyes of the world are looking towards the advent of this great Savior, Imam al-Mahdi. May Allah hasten his reappearance so that his eminence comes to establish the divine rule of the Almighty Allah for every single human being, is completely dependent and needs this divine rule of the Almighty Allah. And it is this divine rule of the Almighty Allah, the kingdom of God that is to be established by Imam al-Mahdi, may Allah hasten his reappearance, which will bring about ultimate justice in a world which is filled with cruelty and injustice. Welcome back, dear listeners. This is IRIB English Radio. We are talking about the dialogues of Imam al-Mahdi. May Allah hasten his reappearance on Dialogue. So we are talking about these beautiful dialogues, and specifically we're talking about this dialogue that Imam al-Mahdi, may Allah hasten his reappearance, has with one of his companions by the name of Ishaq ibn Yaqub. And so in this dialogue and in this conversation, we find that Ishaq ibn Yaqub has put forth a lot of different questions to the Imam of the time. And in response to all of these questions, the Imam of the time
Imam al-Mahdi, may Allah hasten his reappearance, he gives him all of these different answers. In one place, it's very interesting, the answer that Imam al-Mahdi, ajalallahu ta'ala, farajahu sharif, gives. His Eminence says that, as for the saying of those people who think that Imam Hussein alayhi salam has not been slain, this is a kind of disbelief, denial, deviation, and misguidance. So what's really interesting here is that apparently there were individuals who thought that Imam Hussein alayhi salam was not martyred, and the killers of Imam Hussein alayhi salam are wrongly accused of killing him, and that apparently someone resembling Imam Hussein alayhi salam had been murdered, and that this was the propaganda that was being made. It was clearly, as the master of the age, Imam al-Mahdi, may Allah hasten his reappearance, spoke about, he said that this is false propaganda, it is fraud, it is deviation, it is a falsehood, it is an invalid claim. What's really interesting is that this seems to be a place or an era where Christian ideology seems to have been seeping into the society of the Muslims. Of course, this idea that Prophet Isa was not slain, but he was alive, or he was resurrected. These were kind of things that were mixed up. And even in the Islamic context, we find that Prophet Isa, Prophet Jesus, alayhi salam, peace and blessings upon him, that he wasn't crucified. Matter of fact, it was somebody who looked like him that was crucified, and Prophet Jesus was raised to the heavens, and that he will return at the end of times with Imam al-Mahdi, may Allah hasten his reappearance. And so it seems like that these things were confused with Imam Hussein alayhi salam, and they were being said about Imam Hussein alayhi salam. And of course, Imam al-Mahdi here, he clearly rejects this notion. He denies this notion. So it's interesting that these kind of things were happening at that time. We find that throughout the history of the 11 divinely appointed imams, this idea of not knowing who the successor was, even though they knew who the successor was, but many times the people, they didn't believe that so-and-so was a successor. So you have these different sects popping up within the Shia community at that time, whether it's the Waqifis, you know, whether they are those who didn't accept Imam Rida alayhi salam, there are those who didn't accept Imam Qadim alayhi salam, there are those who didn't accept Imam Hadi alayhi salam, and so forth. So this idea that we have to be very careful, of course, the 12 divinely appointed imams have been named by the Messenger of Allah sallallahu alayhi wa alayhi. This is Dialogue, Imam al-Mahdi, ajalallahu ta'ala farajahu sharif. IRIB English Radio. Please follow our radio programs and podcasts on iranradio.ir. And now we invite you to listen to Sheikh Osama Abdul Ghani.
After Iman, we came to Nubuwwah. We came to Tawheed. After faith, we came to Tawheed. When we came to Tawheed, we came to a very important conclusion. Tawheed means Allah is one. Does Tawheed just mean Allah is one and not two? Ayat of Quran. If I obey someone besides Allah in disobedience of Allah, it's shirk, polytheism. Ayat of Quran. Let's read this verse together. Inna shayateen. Truly the shayateen. Remember, they're shaitan from ins and jinn. Truly the shayateen. What do they do? Quran. La yuhuna ila awliya'ihim. They do wahi to their awliya. They inspire their friends, shayateen do, liyujadilukum, in order that you might that they might dispute you. Now comes the kicker, shirk, ayat of Quran. Wa in ata'tumuhum, if you obey them, in ata'tumuhum, innakum la mushrikun. Truly, if you obey them, truly you are mushrikeen, polytheist. Obedience of other than Allah is shirk in the Quran, tawheed. After that, we came to Quranic Nubuwwah. Quranic Nubuwwah, our prophets, our anbiya, like Imam Mahdi, they're freedom fighters, they're resistors. They come to tell the pharaohs of the time, set my people free. Allow them to worship God. That's what anbiya say. The tawaghit, those are the ones who don't allow a bloodless revolution. They've been taking advantage of the masses. They stand up to the anbiya. They won't listen to God. So the anbiya have to get their hands dirty.
Thank you very much for listening to this episode of the program, Dialogue. For more information, visit our website at iranradio.ir. Until another episode, God bless you and fi amanillah.
fighting for our lives. They say to their parents, we know that Palestine is our right. They say to their parents, we'll fight for what is right. They say not to worry, God is on our side. They say we'll die for Palestine. Palestine, forever
Palestine. In the limelight.
In fact, the future Israel has created for itself has never seemed less certain. Over 80 years, it has completely failed to integrate into the West Asia region. Instead, it chose to force itself upon the region. The consequences have been catastrophic. The Israeli regime remains what it was at the start, a violent Western outpost in West Asia. Without Western arms, money, and political protection, it cannot survive. It has nothing else to fall back on, and these gifts will not continue indefinitely. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Please stay tuned for the second part. Palestine Chronicle wrote, in May 2024, UNRWA Commissioner General Philippe Lazzarini described Gaza as a war on children. No one should be surprised. The Zionist regime's wars always involve a high casualty rate among women and children. Neither were children excepted from the threats by Israeli politicians and military commanders to annihilate Gaza. The remark by the intelligence officer Ilyahu Yossian that there is no innocence in Gaza, there are 2.5 million terrorists, comes out of a culture in which Palestinians have been dehumanized over decades, as insects and snakes and children as terrorists in the making. Vox Pop street questions usually get the answer that it's all Hamas' fault. This echoes Golda Meir's remark, quote, we can forgive the Arabs for killing our children. We cannot forgive them for forcing us to kill their children, unquote. The excellent behavior of the Zionist regime's forces breaks every convention ever written on the conduct of an army in wartime. The troops send videos back to their families and friends as they humiliate prisoners, blow up universities, mock children in their shattered classrooms, and prance around in homes they have destroyed. They deliberately kill Palestinian children. They fired hundreds of bullets into the car where a five-year-old child, Hend Rajab, was pleading for someone to come and save her. They had previously killed six members of her family, and they killed the two paramedics coming to her rescue. They killed all six of her father's sons, leaving him to bury them. They killed photojournalist Fatemeh Hassouna and six of her brothers and sisters. They murder paramedics and bury them with their ambulances. They have wiped out entire extended families, 60, 70, 80 or more people, so that even the name no longer only exists except on a death register. These are abominable crimes, and there are thousands of them. The argument that Israelis don't know any better because the media filters out what the government doesn't want them to know doesn't wash in the 21st century. they either do know or they could easily find out. Germans in 1940s only had a totally controlled press and radio. They had some kind of credible argument for not knowing, but with the internet and social media these days, Israelis have no excuse. Gaza is not just a handful of psychopaths at the top. This is an entire people, divided amongst themselves. They were hardly brought to this point overnight. Lifelong indoctrination across generations prepared the way. The state Israelis have is the one the early Zionists knew they would need if they were to succeed. They looked on diaspora Jews with contempt. Their model was the state of the Bible, powerful, vengeful, ruthless, and successful in establishing its dominance in the land of Canaan. Its enemies were not just to be defeated, but eliminated, wiped off the face of the earth. This is the Amalek Netanyahu invoked when opening the campaign against the Gaza civilian population. He was summoning up the image of an ancient genocidal state to justify genocide, and the great majority of Israelis went along with it. Less than 80 kilometers from Gaza, Tel Aviv is as remote from death by missile and starvation as Rodolf Haas and his family were from the slaughter on the other side of the wall separating their villa from the Auschwitz death camp. In the film Zone of Interest, Pharaoh Haas picks flowers and shows visitors around the garden. In Tel Aviv, only a short drive from Israel's own death camp, Israelis play netball on the beach, bronze their bodies, or sip a latte in the nearest cafe. They don't care. They are indifferent. Or they justify. Before she died in 2023, Bridget Haas said she was sure her mother knew what was going on over the garden wall, and Israelis knew just as well what is going on over the Gaza fence. As for the killing of Israeli civilians, apart from the fact that many, if not most, were killed on October 7, 2023 by their own military, there is no resistance movement in history that has not involved the killing of innocent civilians. But by whose standards are they innocent? The occupier or the occupied? Who is truly innocent? Was the British settler in Kenya? The French settler in Algeria? Wholly innocent? The German civilian in occupied France or Poland? The Israeli settler, or on the other side of the Gaza fence, living on land stripped of its native population? The settler on the West Bank? The Australian or American living on land seized from the native population? Are they absolved by the fact that these crimes were committed a few centuries ago? If there is a difference, surely it is that we are supposed to know by now that such behavior cannot be tolerated in a civilized world. Finally, to go back to the opening phase of the Gazan stage of the Palestinian genocide, there is a strong evidence that Al-Aqsa storm operation was allowed to go ahead. Netanyahu knew for weeks, if not months, that it was coming, knew it had been planned for a long time, and knew it would be a major attack. He had all the information it needed, from human intelligence on the ground, including the warnings of its troops, to sensors and cameras built all around Gaza, and surveillance footage from drones and satellites. Yet, he did nothing and even waited several hours before reacting with the armed forces. This cannot be interpreted in any other way than Netanyahu allowing the attack to go ahead, wanting it to go ahead as an investment promising a high return. 1,000 Israeli lives invested, Gaza annihilated. Would he be capable of such perfidy? Of course. He is a pathological liar, hardened, heartless, corrupt, unprincipled, a vile messiah leading a cult of lies and death, as a newspaper described him, and that is just Jewish opinion inside Israel. Gaza was evidently the first step in an orchestrated campaign worked out with the United States to clean up the West Asia once and for all. The next step was Lebanon, where thousands of civilians were killed in Beirut and the south, and Hezbollah's leadership martyred. The third step was Syria, whose destruction handed Israel its greatest victory since 1948, possibly even greater than 1967. In fact, the future Israel has created for itself has never seemed less certain. Over 80 years, it has completely failed to integrate into the West Asia region. Instead, it chose to force itself upon the region. The consequences have been catastrophic. The Zionist regime remains what it was at the start, a violent Western outpost in West Asia. Without Western arms, money, and political protection, it cannot survive. It has nothing else to fall back on, and these gifts will not continue indefinitely.
Desde el corazón de Asia Occidental, la hora de Irán te sumerge en el mundo persa. Conocerás su cultura y posición en el mundo.
Hola, queridos oyentes. Bienvenidos a una nueva emisión de La Hora de Irán. Es un placer.